Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
How'd you do that?
Do what?
Light that match. You didn't strike it on anything, it just lit.
Comfort, honey. First thing you've got to learn is not to imagine things.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. Next, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Again, folks, my name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, and I'd also like to welcome my terrific co-hosts, Bobby, Robert, and Dave. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, folks,
Hello.
This show... Hello. Well, folks, this show will be the last one that Bobby and I will be doing from Seattle, Washington.
Oh, no, moving... say it ain't so. Please, say it ain't so.
We're moving back to the East Coast of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in exactly 12 days from today. And Bobby will have more to say about that later. But in the meantime, today's episode...
Oh, we got back you in the music there. If you hadn't recognized the background music, it's from the TV series called Angie, which was set in Philadelphia.
I remember that show. I didn't watch it, though.
Angie Falco... starts a romance with a customer. Yeah, Donna Pasqua played her, and then we had Bradley Bessie,
right,
who played the pediatrician, played by Robert Hayes. Doris Roberts,
yeah,
played her mother. Of course, she always plays the mother anything, so.
I remember that show, but I never watched it. I remember when it was on, though.
Yeah, ran two seasons, 79 and
80. Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm surprised it went two seasons.
And the opening had pictures of Independence Hall and the other Philadelphia surroundings.
That's right. That's right. Now I remember that. Yeah, that's right. There were a couple of few shows like that. There was one that McLean Stevenson was in, too, after he left MASH that was Hello, Larry.
Larry,
and I think
Yeah,
I think that was set in Philly. Yeah, I think that was set in Philadelphia, too. They had some scenes in that from Independence Hall and City Hall and stuff like that. Cool. Okay, well, today's episode is called The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtlebank, and here again is Robert with the opening clip.
Edith, you know what one casket said to the other casket? He said, was that you, Coffin?
And now, Mr. Serling.
I'm the mid-20s, place the Midwest, the southernmost section of the Midwest. We were just witnessing a funeral that didn't come off exactly as planned due to a slight fallout from the Twilight Zone.
Well, thank you, Robert. And to answer Ed's question, thank you. I didn't realize I sounded clearer today, but no, it's not a new microphone. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I'm glad I sound clear anyway. Thanks, Ed. So, this episode, of course, as Rod Sterling said, it takes place in the mid-1920s in a small rural town in the southernmost section of the Midwest. And a man named Jeff Myrtlebank, he returns to life at his own funeral, just rises on up out of his coffin. And the townspeople believe that Jeff must be possessed by a demon, even though the town doctor declares it was more than likely a medical condition that imitated death, such as suspended animation. So that sort of
catatonic,
thing.
Catatonic, something like
yes,
that.
Yes, catatonic type of thing, right. And Jeff seems normal enough. But yet he's changed. He's suddenly become a hard worker with exceptional strength, and he wants to marry his longtime girlfriend, Comfort. And that's some name, Comfort. And she's loyal to him, but she's still a little unsure herself because she's got her I don't know, she's just not too sure if he's really Jeff or not. And the townspeople, they want to run him out of town. So in the climax of the episode, Comfort visits Jeff to warn him about what the townspeople are going to do and to tell him that she does love him. And so he proposes to her, And just as she's about to respond to Jeff's proposal, a truckload of angry townspeople drive up to take on the demon that they believe Jeff is possessed by. And Myrtle
and
Bank...
I got that clip if you want me to go ahead and play
it. Oh, yeah, yeah, go for it. Go for it.
Gents, I say, Jeff, we are here as a committee to speak for the community. Now, we've talked this all over. We done come to the conclusion that Jeff Murderbank is dead.
We think you're a haint.
That's right, a haint. We don't know who you are or where you come from, but we figure you stole Jeff's body. We don't even like you as a neighbor, so we're asking you to move out. Move out, you hear?
What do you say, Jeff?
Well, I think that depends on Miss Comfort Gatewood. I just asked her a question, and she ain't answered it yet.
I reckon I'm with you no matter where we have to go.
And you stand behind me, then. Gents, my wife-to-be and me, now, we was born and raised in this county. We like it. And we don't aim to raise our kids anyplace else.
Now, you
hold
on. Now,
wait a minute now. I heard you out.
Let him speak.
We're gonna stay. And that means just two things. One, if you're wrong about me, then you ain't got nothing to worry about. Because that means I'm just a poor old country boy by the name of Jeff Myrtlebank. But on the other hand, if you're right about me, then you better start treating me pretty nice. Because you just don't know all the kind of trouble I can cause you. I might wave my right hand and bring a whole grove of locusts down on your crops. Then I might wave my left hand and drop all your wells. Then I might snap my fingers and burn a barn or two. And then some morning, if I get up and I feel exceptionally ornery, I might have the hawks come down and steal your chickens. Yes, sir. You folks better start treating me and mine real nice.
Well, that's a different picture, Jeff, with you aiming to Mac Comfort. We sure ain't wanting to hurt her none.
Yes, sir. Sure'd be wrong to hurt her trying to get at somebody else when you fix it on marrying her, Jeff.
Right away, I reckon.
Well, let us know about it, boy. We'll picnic that day.
Yes, quite an inspired speech he makes there. And then they do. They agree to back off. Well, because of fear, mainly, as you can tell. And, well, they say it's because of their fondness for Comfort. And I'm sure they are very fond of Comfort. But, you know, they even say they're going to attend the wedding. You know, but he scared the hell out of them. So after they leave, the interesting scene at the end, Jeff pulls out a pipe and spontaneously lights a match. And Comfort looks at him and she says, Jeff, how did you light that match? You didn't even strike it on nothing. And he laughs and he says, oh, Comfort, you've got to stop imagining things. And he puts his arm around her shoulders and he walks away with her. And in his closing narration, Rod Serling says that Comfort and Jeff are still alive today, which, of course, that was back in 1962, and bore a son who grew up to be a shrewd politician and a U.S. senator. And Serling also says that the son is suspected to have earned his education in the Twilight Zone. So, once
it's
again...
It's Damien! Look out!
Damien, that's right! Damien!
The Omen!
That's right! That's where Damien came in. That would be just about the right time, too. So once again, in season 3, Twilight Zone visits the South. And this time, the trip was a bit more successful than the last few. Jeff Myrtlebank, a tall, strapping young man, seemed to succumb to an illness 3 days prior to his funeral, rises from his coffin, and the minister's given the eulogy, scares the hell out of everybody. And, you know, I like the doctor's idea of why it happened. Ipso suspendo animation. A very interesting and ridiculous diagnosis from Petticoat Junction's Uncle Joe. Well, whatever the reason, this virile young man Junction. And this, of course, this virile young man, he's living and breathing, he's walking around again. And everybody's just spooked out. They're spooked out of their minds, including his own parents, including Comfort, who's supposed to be a sweetheart. And he tries to convince everybody he's the same guy he's always been, but they're a hard sell. And she can't make up Comfort. She can't make up her mind, you know, if she still wants to marry him. Comfort's brother wants to beat the crap out of him.
Oh, flip a coin and decide. Come on.
Yeah, seriously. Okay. Comfort. What a name, Comfort. And his brother wants to beat the crap out of her. Brother wants to beat the crap out of him. He thinks Jeff's a menace. And the town folk, they want to form a posse to run him out of town. He confronts them. He lets them know, you know. He just tells them, yeah, you don't have to worry about me if you're wrong. But if you're right, I will, you know, wreak havoc on your lives, you know. And so, you know, they give up. They just walk off very nicely, say, oh, we'll plan a nice celebration for them. But, you know, I'm going to say right here and now, I am not a fan of James Best. Don't ask me why. I don't know. All I know is I can only say I don't care for the guy. I'm sure everyone reading this or, you know, or I'm sorry, I'm not reading this, listening to this. Everybody listening to this can name one or more actors, actresses that just don't care for. Okay, so I don't care for James Best. He always plays a doofus. He always plays like the country, the dumb country bumpkin. Yeah, he plays Johnny Robb. he always plays a doof, doesn't he? Plays like this wacky hillbilly country bumpkin. I don't know. Just don't like the guy. He went on to that.
You go where the money's at, Lynn. You go where the money's at.
Exactly. Well, his most memorable role, I guess, was he played the sheriff, Sheriff Roscoe Coltrane on Dukes of Hazzard. He was a bumbling idiot there, too, didn't he? Wasn't he a bum? Yeah.
Hey, little buddy.
And yeah, and he played a complete idiot there. He's been a total of three Twilight Zone episodes. He plays the same type of character in all of the Twilight Zone episodes, a complete dope. I mean, really, like just a dopey country dumbass. But to be fair, he did okay in this episode. He played the role the way he was supposed to. So I guess he's good at playing a dumb country bumpkin. But I'm just not a fan of his. Sherry Jackson, she was fine as Comfort. You know, she's still around at the age of, I guess, 70, 71 or something like that. And she's had a pretty successful acting career. Of course, there was a little bit of comedy thrown into this episode. I'm not a proponent of the comedic Twilight Zones, but this one just had a small amount, so I didn't get too upset about it. And also, most people would not notice this, but if you look carefully at the row of mailboxes when they're standing out by the fence at the end, the one mailbox at the very end says and has M. Pittman painted on it, and that refers to Montgomery Pittman, the writer and director of the story. That was a little inside joke in the episode, but this wasn't a clip.
Also, Comfort's name, Southern Comfort.
Southern Comfort. Southern Comfort. That's very good. I didn't even think about that. Southern Comfort.
Now, if we're doing a talking Twilight Zone game, everybody have a drink.
Well, you know, Sherry Jackson was Montgomery Pittman's stepdaughter, so she was in that for a reason. She was Montgomery's stepdaughter. But this wasn't a classic by any means, and it had a little too much conversation at times. But I'd watch it again. In fact, I watched it numerous times during marathons and MeTV viewings, etc. So I give it a 2 rating for average, but nothing spectacular, and I'm never crazy about anything with James Best. So you go ahead, Robert. Tell me what you thought.
Hey, I thought I heard company. How did that?
Well, I really like James Best. I hadn't really had no problem as much as you have. Well, you know, you hate him like I
don't
hate
him. I don't hate him. I'm just not a fan.
Well, you mean you're not a fan of him like I'm not a fan of Shelley Bergen either.
Oh, yeah. Well, Shelley Bergen. Well, who is? I mean, who is? That one, I think
people,
you have a comic consensus.
People. So I think Best is a better step up than Shelley is.
I'll agree with that.
But anyway, yeah, as Lynn says, you know, he's best known for Dukes of Hazzard. He's also made some appearances on Andy Griffith Show, and I brought up that one interview that they did with him where he talked about they asked him if he could play guitar, and he kind of lied to get the role to get on the Andy Griffith Show. And came time to ask him to play, he said he didn't know a lick of notes, and they said, well, you didn't ask me if I knew how to play guitar, you just asked if I had guitar. So but
a little clever.
Yeah, and like I said, he's still alive. He owns his own production company with his wife. So, the seem to have a happy life, but unfortunately this story is not that great. And the one thing is the doctor. I mean, you can't blame the doctor for his medical knowledge. You know, the people seem to be backwards hillbilly people, so the doctor was an old salt bone country doctor, very limited on his medical knowledge. Because I do believe, isn't this set in the 30s or something like that?
1930s,
40s?
Is it 20s? Okay. Yeah, because the car, I'm surprised they were even able to have a car there. But anyway, the Jeff's coming back to life. Could have been easily explained as himself being catatonic. And, you know, the doctor had another name for it because they didn't know what to call something like that. You know, this is something that goes back in time where doctors cannot diagnose it. Catatonic gives off a state of death and therefore can be misdiagnosed in the old days. And if you had the money, of course, way back, if we remember the Edgar Allan Poe, the oblong box, some coffins were equipped with a flag for the person inside to signal someone above if they came back to life. So I think if you had the money and you could afford to do something like that, some people did, because, I mean, even back then, you know, catatonic, you know, even though they didn't know how to call it, it expanded all the way back to, you know, 1500s, 1600s, wherever around that time. You know, we had this word called doppelganger, where it kind of explains a copy of a person, but not the exact person himself. So
like
maybe,
mirror image.
Yeah, so maybe that this wasn't the original Jeff Myrtle Bank, that maybe this was a doppelganger of him, or maybe a spirit did inhabit his body to where he was able to be given powers. You know, there's a movie called The Dead Zone where Johnny in the movie who got into an automobile crash and then wakes up in the hospital and can see the future. You know, those types of things through accidents,
right.
or in this case, Jeff's.
And it became a TV show also.
Yep. I think, wasn't it 4 or 5 seasons it ran with Michael Anthony Hall, something like that?
Yep.
Yep.
Sounds
so
like,
we get the ending, of course. Jeff gives his neighbors a warning, and you've heard the clip and Lynn talk about it as well. I'll tell you what, Comfort is a blonde, not too bright, and, you know, especially the scene that I played at the beginning of the show where she asked about the match light up. So, you know, I think Jeff's got himself a bargain with Comfort there.
Yeah. I agree with
Cook,
that.
I guess he's happy. So.
And we don't even know that yet.
Well, she gives a baby, which turns out the hell demon senator, so.
There you go.
Oh, it's not too bad.
Felix gives it a 2. Felix said he gives it a 2.
Yeah, but with the next episode coming up, which is far better than this one, believe me, this one I kind of give a 1.5 out of 5.
Mm.
I kind of say that this is the prequel to Jezebel, which is in the next season.
Yeah.
And we have him back again, but he plays a different character, and this time Anne Frances is in it, and she's the witch, or the apprentice witch, and so to
yeah,
say,
the witch,
Adam,
yeah.
So.
Well, James Best was in the grave. He played Johnny Robb. Johnny Robb, he played a dumb bumpkin in that, too. Boy, he really played a dumbass in that one. Remember that? Remember the grave where Johnny Robb?
Yeah, but I would rather have 22 minutes of this than 51 of that. So.
You're right. I'll agree with you there.
It felt like a Beverly Hills episode without the Clampets and the comedy, or maybe Bon Paul Kettle without the kettles in it. But anyway, like I said, 1.5 out of 5.
All right.
I'll pass it on to Bobby. Bobby?
Oh, do I really have to?
Well, you can get your doppelganger to do it for you, but how do we know that's really you? Are you sure you're not a doppelganger, Bob?
I'm not sure.
Better check before you move, you know.
By the way, I want to welcome guest number eight. Hello, guest number eight. Thanks for joining us.
Let me just say this. If this had been taking place around today's time, and Jeff Myrlbank had awakened in his coffin and seen this episode playing on a screen in front of him, he would have gotten back in the coffin and put the top over his head, because anything to avoid this. It's that bad. It's absolutely dreadful. And Robert stole my thunder, because I was going to mention the Beverly Hillbillies. Who would have imagined that the Beverly Hillbillies, without any humor in it, would be so absolutely deadly? If only Jethro and Greeny had been in it, there might have been a couple of laughs. But as it is, it's absolutely nothing. I'm not going to pretend to have anything to say about this, because I don't. And there's nothing to talk about in it, because nothing happens. The first time Lynn and I watched it together recently, I fell asleep completely. And so today I had to watch it again with her, and in order to get through it, I had to sit on the edge of my seat, not because I was fascinated, but because I had to be as uncomfortable as possible in order to stay awake. And even that way, I was starting to keel over. So it's just absolutely dreadful.
You know what, Bobby? The review we did for The Gift was worse even than this.
Oh, well, we haven't gotten to that yet. I'll have plenty to say about that. But the thing about it is, as I mentioned on every show, I may not like this, but the people over at IMDb do like it, and it just becomes more absurd every time I go over there to check an episode. Apparently, there is nothing wrong with any episode. I've yet to find one they don't like. But I did pick out one review from somebody over there. There's only eight of them, and one of them, and I just want to quote a couple of lines out of his review. To show you what the thinking is over there, he writes, and this is from him, not from me, a great example of one of the best shows ever, at least one of the best written. While maybe not the best episode, this is my personal favorite. The acting is good, the direction fast-paced, a great example of small-town paranoia and black humor, holds up well today. Love the ending. I will agree with one thing. I loved the ending, too, because it meant it was finally over. So I will agree with that part of it. But what gets to me, I love the people who write over there and the way they write. He writes, he says one thing, and then he immediately contradicts himself in the second line. A great example of one of the best shows ever, at least one of the best written, while maybe not the best episode, this is my personal favorite. So it is one of the best, but it's not the best. So of course,
Bobby Ed said... Bobby Ed said, clearly that person has brain damage.
Well, you'd have to watch this story and actually enjoy it.
From the backwoods somewhere.
But it's absolutely miserable. And I agree, I've never liked James Best either, and that's because he really has always been very one-dimensional. But as Robert just mentioned, you go where the money is. And for him, that is where the money is. He's still alive today at 86, believe it or not. I have no idea what he looks like. He's 86 years old.
Oh, his picture's over. A recent picture of him is on IMDb.
Oh, really?
He's all white hair. Yeah, all white hair and everything.
The thing about it is that not only is he still living, he's still working. He has parts in two movies, one coming out later this year and one coming out in 2013, where presumably he's playing somebody's great-grandfather, I suppose. And IMDb lists 183 different appearances in movies and TV shows. So it's hard to criticize that if you set out to be a character actor and you just want to keep working, this is the way to do it. Robert was right.
Even if you're stereotyped, well, as long as you keep getting roles, who cares?
Some people don't care if they're stereotyped, because you just want to make a living. If you
want to
make a living as an
roles.
Actor and you do that well enough, and I have to admit he does do it very well, then that's, you go with that, and that's what he has done. But generally, in everything I've ever seen him in, I know what he did in The Dukes of Hazzard. I didn't watch The Dukes of Hazzard, or I wouldn't be coherent today at all, and I wouldn't be able to speak at all, but I stayed away from that show. But the thing is that he's always playing those kind of parts, and it just is true. I do agree with what was just, I think Robert just said, I think you were talking about Jezebel, that hour-long thing.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
I'd rather sit through this 12 times than even sit through that once. That is absolutely unbearable.
Ed just wrote that he thought that James Best was dead.
I thought so, too. But, I mean,
his hair's all white. There's a picture of him on IMDb, a recent picture. He's 86, yeah.
Yeah, it is amazing. And all I can say is, you know, if you want to keep working long past retirement age, this is the way to do it, because he's had such a career that, you know, casting directors will look at that and go, oh, yeah, we need an idiot and a country bumpkin. Now, is James Best still alive? Yeah, he is. Okay, let's get him. So he'll probably work until the day he dies. I don't doubt it at all. But as for the story itself, I can't stand it. I'm always amazed, like I am every time we go through this, that the Twilight Zone can be so good and so bad from week to week. It is hard to believe. Robert just mentioned the fact that, you know, we're coming up on one of the all-time classics when we get back on the air in November. And yet this comes right before it. I have no idea why, but I will say this. It was still better than TV is today, because I'd rather have a TV series that was horrible one week and fabulous the next week than what we have today, which is horrible every single week. So I'll take that any time. But it is quite strange that Rod Serling, he even in the episodes he didn't write, thankfully he didn't write this one, even lets it go, even approves it for his show. I just don't imagine what he was thinking. And I said the same thing when we get to the gift, which we recently reviewed on our message on our board.
Which at my Lurch soundbite, I'd be playing that right now.
Yeah. Tell me about it. And it just is remarkable. You would think that a man that talented and that good would look at it and go, you know what, this is my show, and I really don't think that this is going to fascinate people. But some people do like it. All I know is, I'm going to go in later today and do what I've never done in our polls at the group. You can go back and change your rating.
I'm there right now.
Anytime, as long as the polls are still open. And I gave it a 1. I have no idea why. But I read the reviews that were posted back when we did it, and one of our members, Paul, gave it a 0. And I wouldn't want anybody to give something a 0 and not have me do it. So I'm going to take my rating from 1 down to 0. Because I think
you don't want Paul to be alone. So
yeah, because I'm well known as hating everything. So I don't want to end. I don't want to leave Seattle with that hanging over my head. So
you don't hate everything. You there's a lot that you like.
And well, I came around on the trade-ins. Remember, I said that it wasn't. I had problems with it, but in the end, I did like it after all.
At least you ain't green and living up in a mountain there with a little dog and I must stop Christmas from coming.
So that
you've given a lot of episodes a 5.
Oh, I know. I'll give it a this person who posts IMDb, apparently he thinks that this is as good as Time Enough at Last. So
Oh, give me a break.
Well, he didn't say that. No, he didn't say that specifically, but he did say it's one of the best ever, maybe the best.
That's a knee slapper.
If he didn't say that, that means it's better than that, and better than The Served Man, better than everything. What can I say?
But you know what? If you go on to IMDb and you look up, if you were to look up all 100 and, 20 episodes, 150, how many?
156.
If you were to look up all 156 episodes, there's always somebody in there that says every episode has somebody says that's my favorite. King Nine Must Not Return, one of the worst episodes of the series. Somebody in there said it was the best episode of the entire series.
But see, I don't think that way. I have a different opinion about that. If you have a really great episode, series that's a classic that you personally like or that many people remember for decades afterwards, that puts more pressure on it to be good, not less. I can't look at it and say, oh, well, it's a great series, so I'll let this one go. I don't act that way at all. If you really want to be remembered that way, you got to be good most of the time, if not all of the time. Not classic, but at least bearable, okay? Not classic,
right.
But at least bearable.
But even the worst episodes, some of the very worst episodes, there's always someone
right,
that says, that's my favorite. That's the best one of the series. There's always someone that loves it.
Oh, absolutely. And the problem with that is that when you're looking at something overall and you're trying to pick the best thing out, you can't like everything, or you never come to a consensus about what's good. Give an example, on cable TV, for those people who have the Food Channel, they have many shows on there, and they have a new one on right now, which people travel around the country, go to different restaurants, try to find the best hamburger, the best hot dog, this, that, and the other. And there's a new show right on there right now, these days, which a man is traveling across the country trying to find the best hamburger in America. But everywhere he goes, he announces that that's the best hamburger he's ever had. Well, then what do I take from that? By the time the series is over, I get nothing because everything he has is fabulous. So I think you got to really be critical. When you're really trying to find out what's the best is, you've got to really come down hard on the bad ones, because that makes the good ones look even better. All right, that's it for me. I'll give it a zero, and like I said, I'll change my rating because I think it deserves it. All right, Lynn, back to you.
Okay, Dave.
Why do I get the feeling that he's happy when he gets one of zero? I mean, you sound so chirpy when you say that, Bobby. It's great.
Oh, really? Okay. I'm glad you're joining. All right.
No, I haven't really got a rating myself because I didn't get a chance to rewatch this. I've only got very dim memories of it, but it seems as though it's very much a sort of churn out another episode, and I certainly go with Lynn. There's something about the main actor James Best that didn't appeal to me. I don't know what it was. We had a similar situation a while back, Lynn, where we had the one where the chap was walking his dog, and the gatekeeper, and he nearly went into hell. And there was a strange man that he talked to. The I don't know if he was gay, but then
hello, neighbor Simpson.
I couldn't take to him. And there are some actors like that that I find difficult. Although I think he probably found his niche when he was playing the sheriff in that comedy one, because I always think of that as a kids' program anyway. Just a couple of things to mention. One thing about the series, and reading from the wiki page, the link I put into the show notes for people who want to check back with them, is the thing that that apparently in the closing narration, which I don't remember, Rod Sterling says this, and let me read it, and then I'll make a comment about it. Rod Sterling says that Comfort and Jeff are still alive and bore a son who grew up to become a shrewd politician and U.S. senator. Sterling says that the son is suspected to have earned his education in the Twilight Zone. Now, I'm wondering whether that's a political point coming out there. I'm wondering whether, actually, Rod Sterling's making a very veiled comment that all politicians are spawns of the devil, in terms of the fact that...
Isn't that sometimes like that empowerment there, Dave?
Well, it just seems that, the indication is from everyone, that this chap has been, the body has been taken over by a malevolent spirit of some sort, and if they have a child... I'm just wondering whether he was... I mean, I don't know whether Rod Sterling has... he certainly makes, in some of the past episodes, what he would term, I suppose, moralistic or whatever points. I'm just wondering whether that was... Although he didn't write it, of course.
I was going to say, if you want to compare this, you can compare it to The Whole Truth car, yeah.
And that, before I go on to the other thing I was going to talk about, just makes me maybe ask a question of the room. If Rod Sterling doesn't write an episode, do you think he still writes his closing statement? Or do you think does he take those words from the person who's written the episode itself?
I think he does.
He wrote all his monologues.
Yeah.
Every single one of his monologues.
So then my point stands that it wasn't the fact that it was the writer that was making that point. If he's the one that made that point, then even more to me, it seems as though he was sort of, tongue in cheek, or maybe in a veiled way so it gets past the censors, saying that don't trust politicians.
A good comparison, Dave, is with the Doctor Who series going on right now with Moffat. Because, even though there's different writers besides Moffat himself, he does have a kind of an input in the stories that the other writers write. I think that Rod had the same type of input with The Twilight Zone with the other writers.
All producers do.
The only thing I wanted to just say is that while we've been talking, I've been looking up a little bit about the actress, the lady who played Comfort, Sherry Jackson, who was... she's only about Well, she's getting on towards 30 here, but I mean, she was a child actress, and she also, I'm sure Robert would have said, I can't remember what he did say, she was in a Star Trek episode, What a Little Girl's Made Of, where she actually plays an android, when she was only 24. That's the original Star Trek. If you go to her, she's got her own website, sherryjackson.net, and you can,
really?
You can clip on little YouTube clips that she's got of her there. She's 70 years old, never married. The man she was attached to died after a 5-year relationship. But interestingly, looking around, she was also considered to be at one point a girlfriend of Elvis Presley. Widely reported that Sherry dated Elvis Presley around the year 1960 when she was only 18 years old.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, they all dated Elvis. Elvis dated everybody.
There's a newspaper article about it there and so on. But she said she wasn't. And of course, she has a Hollywood. But she never seems to have married. And there's also another thing there, some photographs of her in Lost in Space, where she appeared in that as well. So. And she was in quite a few cowboy films. Yeah,
she was Montgomery Pittman's stepdaughter.
Right. She played John Wayne's daughter in another film. And she's been in Gunsmoke and played with Clint Eastwood and lots. So she was obviously, a real beauty and one of the sort of young up-and-coming stars of her time. But really, I'm saying that because I haven't got a lot to say about the episode itself. And I always like to just have a look like... We all sometimes are surprised that there'll be, you'll see an episode and, the person who's the oldest one in the episode is still alive, age 97, and somebody else might have, a lot of them died of cancer young, in the 40s, 50s and 60s.
I noticed that with the celebrity today, a lot of them are dying from cancer. It's kind of strange.
I suppose it's... we're about 30 to 40 years from when cigarettes started to have in filter tips. So, I mean, the people that smoke later than that hopefully have been protected a little bit. But we're talking about people that were smoking quite strong, high tar cigarettes with no filters. And maybe, I think it's fairly well proven the connection.
They had filters in the 60s.
Did everybody smoke the filtered ones, though?
The pipes, they had filters for the handles of the pipes. I didn't know when those came.
No, I remember when my mother used to smoke, and I think although I was past, they had to sell filters, but I think quite a few of her friends, they bought them with filters because they have filters on. First thing they do is tear the filter off the end and light that end.
I remember seeing that when I was a kid. I remember seeing people do that, tearing the filter off.
Yeah.
Anyway,
as I say, not a lot to say. It's probably a fairly forgettable A4 page story. But there's always something interesting with these. There's always something you can go, whether the fact that you go looking for interesting things off the screen is an indication that the episode itself wasn't movie gold or TV gold.
Right.
So I'm not too sure I should be actually giving a rating, but I would probably find it harder to give it more than a 2 out of 5.
That's okay. Okay. How about you, Rick?
Everything I wanted to say has been said already. I really can't... I don't have anything against the lead actor, really, although a lot of actors do that. I mean, all right, don't get me wrong. John Wayne was a good actor. But if you really looked at everything he's done, it's basically the same character, just different name.
Never mind different names, Rick. Well, he nearly always played a guy called Nathan.
That's true.
I mean, B-movies back then in the 40s, 30s, and 40s before he really got popular.
He's actually quite good in Stagecoach. I thought he was quite good in his first film.
Oh, no, I'm not saying he was a bad actor. I'm just saying that if you really looked and saw every movie, like, back to back, you'd say, hey, he's playing the same character. It doesn't matter what it is. it's the same character. And it's true, okay? Yeah. it's just that some actors can't do dialogues or different things. It doesn't mean that they're, like I said, you know, I like Wayne.
Adrian.
Hey, look, not every actor can be Charlton Heston.
Come with me if you want to.
Greatest actor of all time.
Or Wally Cox.
Or Wally Cox, right.
Oh,
Wally Cox,
yes, season five.
The two greatest actors of all time.
Anyway, I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
Dave, I'm going to get you. No, Rick, I'm going to get you for that. No, Dave's innocent. I'm going
to
get
coming
out
to you, Dave.
Don't answer both of you. I mean.
Anyway, I'd give it.
Didn't make any real jokes at all.
Like everybody else, I'll give it a 2.
All right, you give it a 2. And poor Ed, aren't you able to get in today to the phone? I don't know, because Ed's here, but he's not, he hasn't called in.
Right now, I'm at the site here, and before Bobby changes his rating, because I know he's eagerly at the site, too, and he's getting ready to press that reboot button.
What, you're going to call him out on something?
No, I just basically bringing up what the ratings were from our group. He was among 4 people that rated a 1. I guess it'll be 3 now when Bobby joins Paul down to 0 there. I kind of split the difference, did a 1.5. I was the only one that voted that way. We have 3 people for 2, which was including.
I gave it a 2, yeah.
Yeah. 2.5, Helen gave that one, and then 3. We had 1 person for that. So no 4s or 5, which I'm not shocked by, but there you are.
Now, Ed is going to be on in a second. He wants to make a couple of comments. He was having some technical problems, so we're going to wait for him because he will be on in a moment. And in the meantime, I just want to
say
one more.
Do some impressions. this is my impression of.
I just wanted to say one more thing that Robert, you are going to do commentaries, right, while we're away for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, Lynn, I got It's a Good Life will be in a couple of weeks. So,
and then you'll pick another. You'll pick the other one that you want to do?
Yeah, after I air that one. The time of where we usually do the show, I will stick the commentary in there. So just that way it won't be an empty feed for people. So be sure to check out the commentaries and have a good listen to that.
Awesome. Well, while we're waiting for Ed, I am going to turn this over to Bobby, who does have some things to say.
Oh,
Bobby,
I was hoping to go last. Oh,
you
go
are
going to
go. Well, you're going to go, but we're waiting for Ed. So Ed's going to say something after you're done. He wants to make his comment on the episode. But while we're waiting for him, you go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lynn. I would just like to remind our listeners that because we are preparing to leave the Twilight Zone West Coast, otherwise known as Seattle, Washington, in just 12 days, and we'll be offline at least until the beginning of November, this program, other than the commentaries that Robert is planning to do, will be off as well, at least in the form it's presented in right at the moment, until Saturday, November 17th, when we will return to the air from the Philadelphia area to discuss a Twilight Zone classic that gets just about universal acclaim in both our viewer poll and even at IMDb, where it gets a 9.2 rating, and just about everywhere else. And that is, of course, To Serve Man, a great way to restart our renewed lives on the East Coast. In conclusion, I do think I would be remiss if I did not say a few final words about Seattle, where I personally have served a 5.5-year sentence and Lynn has served a 2.5-year sentence. I will pass on trashing this city since people who were born here do claim to love it, something that Lynn and I will never understand, in favor of making, well, what amounts to sort of a public service announcement, and that is, if on the day you die you are given the opportunity to spend eternity in either hell or in Seattle, go to hell, and you will never regret it, since to quote the title of an old Twilight Zone episode, although Seattle might be a nice place to visit, and even that is debatable. In the end, this does turn out to be the other place after all, and trust us, you wouldn't want to stay here. In the end, for us, all bad things must come to an end, even this. So, goodbye, Seattle. Goodbye. We'll see you all again in about 5 weeks from our new home in Philly. After that is, we attend the Welcome Home Parade that was being thrown for us in the city. And after, we get the keys to the city from the mayor. See you later. Bye-bye.
Here is to Lynn and Bobby. Congratulations. And here we go. Yes, they're moving out. They're getting ready to load the truck. They're getting ready to go down the road. So you guys are driving, aren't you? All the way from Seattle. Oh,
we're taking a train,
a movie
babe.
Van? Oh, are you going to take the train? Oh,
no, a movie van's taking our stuff, but we're taking the train, yeah. And we've got Ed here, finally, Ed.
Yay, I made it.
Yay.
Oh, my goodness. I can't. Am I the only person who has that much trouble getting on? I don't know what it is.
No.
I call up on Skype usually, and I try to dial in the call number or the call ID, and for some reason it doesn't take it. I mean, it just completely.
You didn't hear the brilliant thing I had to say? I got to say it all over again? Oh, my God.
Oh, no, I got to hear more.
No, he can
hear you. Yeah,
can
hear you. I was hearing
just was on the phone.
Yeah, no, I did hear. I always enjoy your commentaries, no matter what the topic is. I gotta say, Bobby, I do enjoy your commentaries. But anyway,
thank you.
No problem. And I hope.
So you
have Skype. Yeah.
You're not the only. You're not the only. I have Skype too. I mean, you're not the only one. A lot of times you have trouble.
It's really weird. So anyway, so speaking of Bobby's commentary, I like that death is preferable to this episode. That was fun. Rather die.
But he came back
this.
To life, though. That's the scary part of it.
Oh man! Anyway. I'm sorry I'm late here, guys. But I don't like this episode at all. I really
right.
didn't.
No sir. Really, you didn't like it. You didn't like
it. No, it's not. No sir. Didn't like it. No. Didn't like it at all.
Like it at all.
No,
definitely
like
doesn't
all.
Either. Sorry about that, guys.
Daphne didn't like it either.
No. This was,
didn't the bark come over?
I heard her.
There we go.
There she goes. There she goes. Go ahead, Ed.
Okay, so let's see. What didn't I like about this episode? Probably.
Come here, hon. We'll
almost everything. The list is so long, but I won't go on and on. I can't stand the neighbors, the spooked out neighbors that got annoying. I mean, they had in the end, of course, they were right, but it was just the unreasonable fear that Jeff was what he ended up being. You know, I don't know, the bits of humor that were thrown in that didn't really work. James Best and his half smirk. I hate that smirk he does. You know, like when he's trying to be dramatic.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like he thinks that helps with the drama of his line and the delivery, but it just makes me cringe every time he does it. And he's so melodramatic. And I know, you know, we debated this last show about the effect that, you know, acting has and the enjoyability of an episode. But I think this is one of those for me. If they had simply cast somebody else besides James Best as Jeff Myrtlebank, I think it would have improved the episode a lot. And I don't know. He just irritates the crud out of me. But it makes me wonder why Rod Serling, though, recast the same actors like this in numerous episodes. I mean, does anyone have any insight on why he did that? Because he's not the only one he did that with.
Well, he did it with a lot of – I mean, there were a lot of actors that he – like Burgess Meredith and James Best and – who else? Cyril Delavante. I think he had a strong fondness for a lot of actors. He became friends with him. He got I know he was very close with Burgess Meredith. I mean, they were good friends, and he loved him. And I think that's the thing. He just would get a particular fondness for an actor, and he would just decide to use him over and over again. And there are a lot of actors that he does, especially the character actors.
Also, I think I've said this a number of times. I'll say it once again. being friends with a lot of actors, because he was in Hollywood for 30 years before he started The Twilight Zone. A lot of them would come to him, like Meredith, and say, "Oh, I heard you're doing something on TV. I'll tell you what, you don't have to pay me. I want to be on it."
Exactly. Exactly. They just would do it for him. Some of them did it for nothing. I mean, they just really liked it.
Like it's kind of like the Sinatra thing. You know, Sinatra had his group. If anybody remembers Ed Wood, not the greatest of directors, so to say, but he had his own cast that he put in different pictures he did. So,
And he was respected, and they just, you know, they flocked
Hammer to him. Films.
Right. That's right.
Hammer Films had their own
And that's pretty much why he, you know, why you see a lot of them all the time, especially the character actors, Gerald Del Vonte and various actors that were in it over and over again. So, Ed,
I'm going to re-edit the previous episode since I got the clips working again. I got to put that laughter happiness thing on.
So. All right, cool. Ed, what did you rate this episode?
Can we go negative?
Well, go ahead. You can be one good negative one or negative five, whatever.
No, I'll give it a one. I wouldn't go any higher than that, though.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen worse. I'm not gonna. I can't give it a zero because I've seen worse. But
yeah, I have to.
But it's no classic, that's for sure.
No.
Felix from New Jersey said Orson Welles, another one that had a group of people around
him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't Alfred Hitchcock was the same way? Alfred Hitchcock Hitchcock had actors and actresses that he, you know, was very close to, that he, Tippi Hedren, you know, that he just liked using over and over again. Yeah, so I guess they have their favorites.
And blondes. He loved his blondes.
And blondes.
I'm not too sure
blondes.
About Tippi Hedren. I thought he wasn't his advances a little bit
over the line on some occasions.
He was in love with her.
According to her book, he was in love with every actress he had on set.
I think he liked blonde. He liked blondes and boobs.
Yep.
That's like blondes and boobs.
But anyway, I'm going to say good night, good afternoon, or whatever. Hellhound is begging to go out.
Well, we're about ready to end this year. So,
and Lynn, when you're on the train, don't get off at Willoughby.
I will not get off at Willoughby.
No, we'll try not to jump off of that.
And Miss Cliftonville as well. I don't think you want to stop at
Clipperville, exactly. Oh, I'll make sure. And also not Centerville, remember? A nice stop in a quiet town. Stop over in a quiet town. Centerville.
Yeah.
Well, you guys will remember it when you see
it. I remember it.
You remember? Okay.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, we will see you again. We'll see everybody. Don't forget about us, Heath, and Robert will be here with commentaries in the meantime. So
get on your calendar, people. We want you back. We want all
want
nice, shiny faces back. Yep.
So wish us luck.
Goodbye, Seattle.
Goodbye, Seattle. Wish us luck, and we will see you again from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So bye-bye, everyone. Oh, and I forgot to mention, we're going to be doing To Serve Man. So we're going to get to
Yay!
Yes.
All right.
Yay!
That's a good
episode
for a change.
Yeah, it's a good classic, so we will be doing that one. So goodbye, everybody. Have a wonderful month, and I hope you guys miss us, because I'll miss you guys. See you in Philly, Felix. Bye-bye.
Have a good trip.
Thanks. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
And as we go out, we have a PSA from our favorite person, Rod Serling. So goodbye, everybody.
This is the Morgan family coming home from the lake. Ed and Marilyn have been married 12 years. That's Kelly, Sue, and Casey in the back seat. They've driven this road a dozen times before, and nothing ever happened. But today is different. Today, Ed will become a killer. And here's his weapon. good old Ed Morgan, a mighty careful man in his own home. He can't imagine how anyone could have been so careless. Ed Morgan, every man, anyone who handles fire in any form is a potential killer. Anyone can start a fire and never even know it. Please be very careful with fire. Please. Only you can prevent forest fires.
You are a bold and courageous person, afraid of nothing. High on a hilltop near your home, there stands a dilapidated old mansion. Some say the place is haunted, but you don't believe in such myths. One dark and stormy night, a light appears in the topmost window in the tower of the old house. You decide to investigate, and you never return.